Thank you, Mr. Seifert. Good afternoon, all of you. Nice to see you. Nice to be with you all. Some of you know that I had a chance to attend the Church's College in Southern California a long time ago. I was an entering freshman in the year 1970. And in those years and subsequent years, all the freshmen were required to take a particular class. It was called The Life and Teachings of Jesus. In those days, it was taught by Dr. Roderick Meredith, who was all of age 41 in those days. Now, that wasn't his only responsibility. He was the head of the ministry, which means he oversaw hundreds and hundreds of paid elders. Great responsibility for a young man. Well, I don't have to tell you old-timers also that there was something called authority in the church in those days. And as he was teaching the class, a young man raised his hand. And Dr. Meredith called on him. And the student stood up. The student spoke good English, but he came from the country of Israel. And he knew Hebrew. He took exception to how the term biblical law was being characterized. And while he started to address the teacher, he then turned to the rest of the class and began speaking. And I thought, well, this is going to get interesting. You know, I was only new in the church 9 months, but I knew that was a violation of protocol. Now, it turns out that it appears Dr. Meredith had met the young man, the Israeli student whose name was Mordecai, somewhat before. And Dr. Meredith was gracious. He let him finish out his thought. I remember what Mordecai said, but it took me over 30 years before it clicked in my head what it meant. I mentioned that Mordecai had taken exception to how biblical law was being characterized. And when he was talking to the class, he said the following words. He said, "You misunderstand the term law as it's used in the Bible. The Hebrew law, a word for law, is Torah. It means," he said, "teaching." The same root for that word is used for another couple of words, my father and my mother. Now, I wanted to be sure I had it right, so I looked it up online before coming here. And indeed, Mordecai was right. In fact, United Church of God has an excellent book called The New Covenant, Does It Abolish God's Law? And on page 19, it says the following. The word Torah, or phrase, the law, means the teaching. Now, if you want a title for this message, it's real simple. It's the teaching. And if we were all clear on it, I could sit down now. There'd be no need to say anything further. I mentioned it took me 30 years before what Mordecai said about the teaching clicked in my head. I don't think I was slower than most people, though it's possible. But why would the head of the ministry in those days give a presentation of biblical law that a young Hebrew-speaking Israeli student felt to object to? And even, if we can say, correct the teacher. I think it all goes back to a misunderstanding. Because when we come to the word law, in English, it means something in our mind. It's how we grow up with the word law. And it's different than what the meaning of the Hebrew means when they say the word Torah. Let me try to illustrate how we come to it in English. I raised my family for the early years in Southern California. And my wife is from Pennsylvania. So every year, we would try to get back and see her family. And back in California, when you're driving on the freeway in those days, I don't know what the law is today, but the California Highway Patrol had no radar. That was kind of nice. The California Trucking Association had lobbying ability in Sacramento, and so they didn't want their truckers to get tickets. So the Highway Patrol couldn't use radar. If they wanted to give you a ticket, they had to visually come behind you, track you for a quarter mile, clock your speed, and pull you over and write you a ticket. Not only that, but all the cars were two-tone, black and white. And so we had a culture of mirror watchers. As long as you were really careful at watching the rearview mirror, you could outsmart the Highway Patrol, not get a ticket. That was ubiquitous. Further, it also meant that everybody went faster than the posted speed limit, maybe 10 or 15 miles per hour. Well, if you did not, and you insisted on going, let's say, 55, in dense traffic, on highly traveled freeway speeds, you became, by virtue of the law of physics, a real life-threatening road hazard. So when we're in Pennsylvania and we're traveling, they have radar on the highways. I wasn't driving, of course. My wife was. And we were all tired, and it was night. We were cruising along, and all of a sudden, the whole car lights up with, you know, red, white, and blue flashes. Somebody said something happens around your heart when one of those things happen. We pulled over. Cop comes up. Forgive me, the Highway Patrol officer comes up, and he was nice. So your driver's license, registration card, please, insurance. He sees it, takes it back to his patrol car, comes up a few minutes later, and his demeanor had changed because, you see, he saw that California driver's license. And he learned or understood that California and Pennsylvania jurisdictions don't talk to each other. There's no reciprocities. So you could receive the ticket from the officer, say, thank you, officer, go home, dump it in the trash, and that'd be that land, and you'd never have to worry about it again because the two states didn't communicate with each other. Now, the Highway Patrol officer knew that, and so he changed into a, I'm a cop, swagger, gun on my hip. See my badge? And I'm going to tell you something. You go home, you don't end up paying this ticket, you're going to get a bench warrant for your arrest, and one of these days you're going to go to jail. I understood the game. He went back to his patrol car. We had a 5-year-old daughter in the back seat. Patrol officer's gone. She burst into tears. Is mommy going to jail? You know, it took 15 or 20 minutes of long discussion to comfort her mind that mommy wasn't going to jail. Now, my point is, that's her introduction to the English word law. A cop and a badge and a gun, and you're going to go to jail if you have an infraction. Well, it wasn't the Hebrew meaning of the word, which is the teaching. But that's how we encounter the word law. Now, let me change gears for just a moment. When the founder of the Worldwide Church of God in the 1930s came along, he was dealing with a Christian America. I don't think anybody argues that we're in a Christian America today. We're in a post-Christian America. I grew up in the 50s and 60s on a farm in Minnesota. And I remember going to church on a Sunday morning, my father driving the car. All the stores were closed. Nobody worked on Sunday. Except maybe there'd be an occasional farmer out in the field. Very rare. And my father would see the farmer, and as we were driving, he'd say, oh, Farmer Johnson's working in the field on a Sunday. And everybody in the car knew that Farmer Johnson was breaking the fourth commandment. That's how different America was. Well, that's the America that the founder of the Worldwide Church of God came into. And when he discovered, against his will, that an Old Testament day, the Sabbath day, had merit and benefit for New Testament, New Covenant Christians, he reluctantly, but then afterwards, with some enthusiasm, embraced the day and began looking around for somebody to fellowship with. He came across what he thought was the best evidence of a church that he could attend in Oregon called the Church of God Seventh Day. And after a while, he thought, well, if the Sabbath comes from the Old Testament and it's applicable to Christians, are there any other biblical laws that might be? And you know the history. You discover that, well, clean and clean, unclean meats were followed in the New Testament. And here we have these holy days that were mentioned in the Old Testament, had relevance to Christians. And so he wrote up a paper talking about these things and presented to the leaders of the Church of God Seventh Day. And I've heard him say this over and over and over again in sermons in person. He said, "They, the Church of God Seventh Day, laughed me to scorn." And when they talked about the holy days, he said, they spat out the word Jewish holidays. Now, this is remarkable. In a Christian America, a minority church keeping an Old Testament Sabbath, they had hostility towards other biblical laws. Okay. There was a Seventh-day Adventist who wrote a landmark publication named Dr. Sam Bakayoki. The book was called From Sabbath to Sunday. And he began to explain why there was this hostility, not only to the Sabbath, but also to biblical law in general. He said, there were a confluence of factors. In 1st century AD, Rome began to persecute the Jews. And Christians in the church in the late 1st century came largely from paganism, didn't want to be persecuted, and they began to put some distance between Jews and themselves. So, the same thing happened then about 325 AD, where the Council of Nicaea came along and formalized Christian doctrine, expunging anything that might have vestiges of things that belong to Jews, which mean biblical law. And if we come forward to Martin Luther in the 1500s, we have a Protestant Reformation, and Martin Luther, equated biblical law with legalism. They were to him one and the same. And he hated it. He thought it undermined grace. I found a quote from Wikipedia I wanted to share with you. This is from Martin Luther. It says, Luther expressed antagonistic views towards Jews, writing that Jewish synagogues and homes should be destroyed, their money confiscated, and liberty curtailed. My point in rehearsing this is that there have been in normative Christianity 2,000 years of hostility towards biblical law. So in the 1930s, when the founder of the Worldwide Church of God came along, and he wanted to talk about the Sabbath or biblical holy days, he had to find a way to burst through this fog of disbelief and discounting and hostility to our biblical law. And in the radio programs and in the articles, he would use the following phrase. You old timers will know this. I can still hear him saying it with authority. If you break God's law, it'll break you. Now, I happen to believe the statement is true. If you persist in breaking the laws of God and you mess up, your life is going to get messed up. That's just the way life happens to work. It'll also happen to earn you the death penalty. But there's a danger, because if you say this with all capital letters in print, triple exclamation marks like it was, there's a risk involved. And the risk is that you're going to present biblical law like the highway patrol officer did, gun on his hip. You're going to get a ticket or go to jail. Like my 5-year-old daughter encountered the word law in English. And I believe it's the reliance on the English meaning of the word law, not the Hebrew meaning of the word law, is where we take a slight deviation. If we're not careful, we end up in a bad place. Now, the fact that we did this with English, that's the only language we have to work with. That's understandable. Let me try another analogy. If we get it wrong, we risk making biblical law like the IRS code, and it risks turning God into an IRS auditor, looking over your tax return, ready to punish an infraction. I believe that is a wrong take on the law of God. And the risk is that we are at risk of getting a twisted view of God as being a consummate legalist with a mind to punish every infraction. Now, if we tumble to such a view, or if we have the vestiges of it today, there are consequences to such a conclusion. Let me try to illustrate. On the church's three campuses, of the college campuses, there were employees that worked for the college. And if there was a printing press there, they worked for the church in the printing press. Well, there was a desire to have the employees, students, not be compelled to have their kids in public school. And so there were schools built called Imperial Schools, and you could have your kid go there if you're an employee or a member in the area from first grade on up through 12th grade. Now, in the latter years of Imperial School, they were outstanding academically. So what I'm about to tell you doesn't apply to the latter years. It will apply to the former years. Because in the early years of the church, using the concept of biblical law, in my opinion, they incorporated corporal punishment. Now, the kids didn't call it corporal punishment. They used the word SWAT. Not like a SWAT team with a police department. This was SWAT, and it didn't mean a SWAT with a fly swatter. It meant there was a board, maybe 2 feet long, maybe an inch thick. It had a handle on it. And should a student, transgress with some infraction, boy or girl, come up in front of the class, bend over, grab your knees because they want that derriere nice and tight. Boy or girl, didn't matter. Teacher, Christian teacher, wail on the backside of that student. Now, I didn't go to Imperial School. When I was in school growing up in Minnesota, I had that happen on one occasion. And I remember it stung for a good 30 minutes. Now, 50 years ago, that sort of thing was legal in California. I had a friend named John Hegvold who told me a story. Unbeknownst to the teacher, he had a pair of pliers in his back pockets of his jeans. Now, John was a quiet, unassuming fellow, the last person in the world to cause trouble. But teacher had him come up there and line up with the other guys who were goofing off in some fashion. And John found his voice. He protested. He said, "I didn't do anything wrong. Why am I getting a SWAT?" Now, I want you to listen to the answer you receive from the teacher, Church of God teacher, Christian teacher. Jesus didn't do anything wrong either. And he was beaten. Brought down the SWAT on his rear end, hit the pliers, shattered the board, put it into splinters. Okay? What happens if the early generation of the church grows up with a mindset towards the law of God like that? Are there going to be consequences? Well, I don't think we have to wonder about it anymore. Because in 1995, we saw the end results. The worldwide Church of God changed its view of biblical law, didn't it? And three out of the four men who were the prime movers of the doctrinal changes had attended Imperial Schools in their youth at the same time my friend John did. Where SWATs were being arbitrarily and liberally administered. I believe in Imperial School and in the church in those days, because of the reliance on the English word, were taught a narrow, restrictive, legalistic form of biblical law. As it happens last week and on TV, a fellow by the name of Dr. James Dobson was interviewed. A good number of you might know him. He was the founder of a program on radio for decades called Focus on the Family. Millions and millions of Christians listened to him. His specialty was child psychologist, graduate of USC in Southern California. And there he appeared on the TV, his adult son, when I was about 35, 40 years of age, having his own children. And the interviewer was curious. You know, your son turned out halfway right. Why was it? Because he was also a preacher's kid. And not all preacher's kids turn out right. Dobson, now an older man, said one sentence right off the bat. He said, rules without relationship equals rebellion. Let me say it again. Rules without relationship equals rebellion. And what he meant was, if there wasn't a relationship with the rule giver with the child that was benign or charitable, you're going to end up generating rebellion. I'm reminded of another educator. Her name was Dr. Toni Grant. She struggled as a single mom, but she was a clinical psychologist. She said something years ago that I never forgot. She had two teenage daughters, and they were giving her a difficult time, as you can imagine teenagers do, trying to push the boundaries. And as a single mom, she said, I got right in their face. She was a soft-spoken lady. And she said to them, in no uncertain terms, I only have one chance to get this right, and I love you too much to let you screw it up. Well, that's interesting. The kids maybe didn't like the rules, but they knew mom had a heart for them, and it came from a good place. It's not likely when the kid knows it's coming from a good place that you're going to have a rebellious child when those rules are there. We won't turn there, but I'd like to point out something to you. In the New Testament, there's a remarkable statement. This is found in John 14 and 23, if you want to write it down. John 14 and 23. Jesus is talking. I'll quote it for us. Jesus answered and said unto him, if a man love me, he will keep my words, and my Father will love him, and we will come unto him and make our abode with him. Do you realize what's going on? The Father and the Son, the heads of the universe, are offering to come down and live with a human being. That's the most precious and intimate relationship that can ever be established in the universe. And when a person realizes that there's a relationship like that that is offered, then the laws of God are not likely to generate rebellion. Should it be any surprise to us that these young men that I spoke of earlier, I had classes with them. One of them was a dorm mate of mine, all of whom grew up in the church, went to Imperial School, hated biblical law as it was presented to them. And when they got older, they got the legal reins of the corporation, the Worldwide Church of God. They ended up relegating biblical law to that as something that God imposed upon the Jews only, and that for a temporary period of time. Now, if you live through these things, you know these things. If I had to think about us, I would imagine that the primary scripture that stops one of us from adopting their view would be found in Matthew chapter 5. We'll turn there. Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 17. It's an old, familiar scripture. I'd like to show something a little bit new in here today, maybe. Let me back up with some context. Jesus is talking to Jewish men. And like any good teacher, he says, now I want you to get something. Don't misunderstand what I'm about to teach. There's a danger. Don't misunderstand. Any parent does that with a child. I don't mean this time. Listen carefully. I mean something slightly different. Matthew 5 and verse 17. Heart of the Sermon on the Mount. This is one of Jesus' preliminary statements to it. I'm going to read this in the NIV because I love the clarity of it. Do not think I've come to abolish the law or the prophets. I've not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth disappear, not the smallest letter, not the least stroke of a pen will by any means disappear from the law, until everything is accomplished. Therefore, anyone who sets aside one of the least of these commands and teaches others accordingly will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever practices and teaches these commands will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Now, if Jesus intended the law, biblical law, to be temporary, he would have never used the phrase, until heaven and earth disappear. To his listeners, Jesus was representing the law, biblical law, as being permanent. But that leaves us in this room with a problem. Because, you see, we can read the Old Testament laws, can't we? And to be frank about it, there's some really weird things in there, right? There's talking about fringes on garments. There's talk about the forbidding of mixing of different fabrics in a garment. There's talk of purification rituals. All of these things fall strangely on our ears. Now, if Jesus meant what he said when he said every jot and tittle will be in effect until heaven and earth disappear, where does that leave us? New Covenant, New Testament Christians. I had a very sharp teacher who was asked this question one time, and I was stunned at his answer. He said, referring to biblical law in the Old Testament, they all apply. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. I was confused for about a week thinking about it. But then he came back with the answer and explained it. He said, if you have a biblical law, that's just a short, truncated version. Underneath the biblical law is a principle. It's huge, and it's deep, and it's permanent. And that principle can apply to all peoples and cultures throughout all of time. But, he said, you have to understand what a particular law is trying to teach. Now, fortunately, we have a perfect example for this in the New Testament. If you turn with me, please, to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9. And to refresh our memories for the context, this is the Apostle Paul. Apostle Paul is the apostle to the Gentiles. That's important for this discussion. Paul, through his own efforts, had raised up the Corinthian church, ancient city in Greece, by himself. He didn't ask any money of the Corinthian church, worked making tents, probably from weaving it from black, long goat's hair, and these tents had commercial value. He consciously did not ask money of the Corinthians so as not to put a stumbling block in their way. But when Paul was away from them, they got suspicious of Paul and wondered if he had ulterior motives. Some of them wondered if Paul was in it for the money, even though he never took a dime from them. And so Paul found it necessary to teach this new young church that although he didn't take any money, he had the legal right to do it in God's mind. So we come to 1 Corinthians verse 9. Paul's about to explain these things, why he has the legal right. Start in verse 8. Do I say these things as a mere man? Or does not the law say the same also? For it is written in the law of Moses, quote, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain. That's from Deuteronomy 25 and verse 4. What in the world is Paul doing? What in the world does this mean? And why would he use an Old Testament law given to the Hebrews over here to Greek-speaking Gentile Christians and think that it's going to carry moral authority? But that's exactly what he was doing. Paul was appealing to a tiny, obscure law in the written law to carry moral authority. Now, let me try to attempt to explain what's going on originally. If you harvest grain, there were two grains in the Middle East. You had barley, and you had the wheat harvest. And they grow up on a stalk of grain. You might have 10, 20, or 30 seeds that occur on the stalk. But during the growing season, they're really tightly affixed. You've got to withstand storms, rain, whatever it is, a lot of wind blowing back and forth, and that seed's not going to come off. Well, all the value is in the seed, isn't it? So what you do is when the crop is about ripe, you cut the bottom of the stalk, and you lay this all out maybe 100 feet on some rocks, threshing floor, flat places you can. How are you going to get the seeds out? Well, you got to hope the sun continues to shine, the wind continues to blow, and you dry out, because eventually those seeds are going to become, and the stalks will be brittle, and you want seed to fall off. But to encourage this, you use the ox, because the ox has four sharp hooves. And when they come down on a flat, hard, rocky place, they're stepping all over these stalks, they're stepping on the seeds, and the seeds fall off. And then afterwards, you have those valuable seeds. You collect them. Maybe you grind them into a meal or to flour. But that's the value that the ox is creating for you. So what does the scripture say? Don't muzzle the ox that treads out the grain. Why? Why don't you want to muzzle over the ox? Because the ox wants to reach down every chance it can get and grab a mouthful of your profit. That's what it wants to do. Let me try to illustrate this further. I want to try and make this so clear you never forget it. I mentioned earlier I grew up on a farm in Minnesota. It happened to be a dairy farm. We had 38 stalls for dairy cows in the barn. Now, they were outside during the day. How to induce them to come into the barn in the evening and then stand still to get milk? Well, we would give them shelled corn, which to them is like candy. You put a pailful or so in front of the stall where they're going to stand. Then you open the gate, and they know that grain is there, and they come running in like crazy. Now, a cow has a long nose filled with sensory organs, and they can smell their own stall. They know their body scent, and they'll find their way right to it. And they'll go up, and they'll come ahead through the stanchion, eating that grain lustily. You clamp on the stanchion shut, now they're locked in place, and you can milk them without fear of them running away. Except some cows are more clever than others. Not only do they know they have grain, but their neighbor cow has grain also. So when they come running in the barn, the more clever ones will run into their neighbor's stall, get down on their front knees, big tongue hanging out, grab in like a big snow shovel as much food as they can in their mouth, put their head in the air so it doesn't fall down. And if you catch them or yell at them, poke them with a stick, they know they've been bad cow, you know. Jump up, get into their own, eating their own grain, neighbor's grain half gone. Any chance they get. Now you might think of it as you opening a restaurant and having only teenage boys work for you. And you say, I'll tell you what, here's a base salary, but you can eat all the food you want. Maybe you'll make a profit, I'm not sure. Well, the same thing with the oxen. You put a muzzle over the ox. And here's God saying, no, no. Don't put a muzzle over the ox. Okay, don't put a muzzle over the ox. Why is Paul using that over here about getting paid? Or is there a reason for it? First of all, I want you to notice something. Beginning in verse 9, Paul says, is it oxen God's concerned about? And the implied answer is no. God wasn't the first charter member of PETA. You know, people for the ethical treatment of animals. And then verse 10, or does he say it all together for our sakes? For our sakes, no doubt, this is written, that he who plows should plow in hope. Here's what Paul is saying. When the ox is treading out those seeds of grain, it's creating value for the owner, isn't it? You can't collect the seeds. If the ox didn't do its work, it wouldn't have the seeds. Shouldn't the ox be allowed to eat some of the value it's created? That's the intent of the passage. Paul said it isn't about oxen. Paul used his mind, thought beneath the statute to the principle. Okay? Saw what the principle was, picked it up, carried it forward 1,500 years to a Greek-speaking people who were Gentiles. New Testament Christians said, here's my authority. Where? In the written law. Okay? It's not about the oxen, even though I talked about it. It's about humans. Whoever does the work has the right to be paid. So Paul came along, worked for himself, creating value for this Corinthian church. What kind of value, you say? Spiritual value. Obviously, the people in the church in Corinth thought they were wealthier towards God, didn't they? After Paul came, now they have a chance to live forever. And Paul is saying, is it any big deal if I, like the ox, eat some of the value I created, if it's even your material things, to pay for my living expenses like food and some clothing? But I want, we can finish it out. Verse 11. If we have sown spiritual things for you, is it a great thing if we reap your material things? And Paul is saying, whoever does the work has a right to be paid. Now that's the model, that's the illustration that Paul used, but there's something deeper. What I want you to see is that Paul looked at the law, saw the principle underneath it, which was great and powerful. It wasn't about the ox, it was about people. Paul picked up the principle again and used it 1,500 years later for different people in a different context. You see, Paul believed Jesus' words. The law was permanent. Even the jots and the tittles. But Paul gave us a wonderful model of how to approach biblical law. Because biblical law, you remember, means teaching. The teaching. Paul wanted you to grasp the teaching that's embedded within the law. Paul had to think about the ox statute and see the principle underneath it. The law, you see, was far richer and deeper than just the narrow meaning that the English words might convey to you. All of you in this room know who Albert Einstein is. Great physicist, did most of his work in the early 1900s. I read an interview of him one time. He said when he was in the zone, as it were, in his mind, thinking really deeply about physics and the very building blocks of the universe itself in physics, he said, when you really get down to it, you know, God could have done it this way, or he could have done it that way. And then he said this phrase, I want you to remember this one. Almost, he said, you can hear God thinking. Well, the example Paul gives us is that when you look at the written law and you think about it, you're reading God's thoughts. Not physical law, that's a spiritual law. Let me close with a final illustration. Lived in Southern California. Didn't have any children at the time. I had a friend I hadn't seen for 10 years. Came to town. And we were probably going to go to a restaurant to eat. And where we lived, on the other side, to get to the restaurant, there was an expensive city called San Marino. Something on the order of Beverly Hills. They were a wealthy city. And the road that we had to go through went for about a half a mile through San Marino. Now, they had different laws in San Marino. Where the law might be where we live might be 35, and the law on the other side of San Marino would be 35. Where San Marino came, it was 25. And they were a rich city, so they had lots of police cars, very little work to do, and guess where they liked to park? On that short stretch that said 25. So we're driving along, and I'm chatting away with my friend, hadn't seen him in 10 years, and I realized I'm on the stretch of road that's in San Marino. And I hit the brakes and slowed down really fast. Looked in my rearview mirror, didn't see any cop. Man had his little girl in the back seat, about age 5, and she goes, Daddy, why did we have to slow down the car so fast? And I, having no children, but all the wisdom in the world answered. Because we don't want a policeman to see us and give us a ticket that we have to pay lots of money. My friend was quiet, 15 seconds, 20 seconds, and then he turned to his back seat and he said, Honey, it's because it wasn't safe. And I felt about that big. Do you realize what happened? I presented to that little girl the same thing that my own little girl had presented to her. The English meaning of the word law. A narrow, restrictive definition with punishment at the ready for any infraction. But my friend presented the Hebrew meaning of the word law. It was there to teach. Because, honey, it wasn't safe. He saw beneath the law and taught her the principle. How do you look at biblical law? Do you look at it like the IRS code, with God as an auditor looking for any infraction? Or do you look at biblical law by first saying that both the Father and the Son want to come and make their abode with you? And as great teachers, open your understanding to the permanent principles that the law is trying to teach.